is from the famine to the blessing.
1300. I want to say a little bit about the support that I'm going to give a little support for Brother Thomas's date there of 1860. People may say, well, there's nothing in 1860 that would be that important. What's so important about 1860? Well, at that time, of course, we know the U.S. was in a great, it was the war of northern aggression, as we, in the, especially Virginians, and we like to state. the war of southern independence, if you want to put it that way. Well, that was one thing. But the frog-like spirits were really emanating out across, not only the beginning in the U.S., but in Europe, the year of revolutions of 1848, those frog-like spirits were, I mean, they were sharpening their swords, so to speak. And Brother Roberts wrote this about the year 1860, and this is very important. We have the first emancipation of the Jew from civil disabilities in all lands except one, Russia, the great enemy of Israel. There has been a great outburst of persecution in various countries, but this is contrary to the law of the land and is being put down with the arm of authority. Brother Roberts continues, the opposition to the Jew is now social. Men are his enemies privately, and they would like to alter the law and are forming associations to try and bring about an alteration. But the law is in favor of the Jew, as it has not been during the ages of downtreading. Of course, many brethren feel that the 2300-day-year period is the correct one. Of course, you know, Alexander the Great's victories at Granicus in 334 and Issus in 333 are used, and we looked at that. And we looked at some of the other dates, so to speak, the 1760-61 period and such. But Brother Roberts continues this about the year 1860. He says, and this change is a latter-day change, this change for the favor of the Jew. It is a change about 30 years old or so, coinciding substantially with the termination of the 2400 period of Daniel 8. The Jew is now eligible to hold landed property, to follow any profession, to vote in municipal and parliamentary elections, to fill any office of authority in the realm. Another fact to be noted is the wonderful wealth of the Jews. This has become quite proverbial. It is a comparatively modern development. Then we behold a work of organization going on among the Jewish race, which is quite a novel thing in their history. Until the present generation, since their dispersion, Israel has been a race of units, having no connection one part with another. But now they are becoming organized. The establishment of a universal Israelite alliance of 1860. Make note of that. Universal Israelite Alliance of 1860. With headquarters at Paris, has laid the foundation of a corporate existence unknown to Jewish life for ages. It has given the Jews a rudimentary nationality which cannot fail to be the utmost importance in all future movements for their national resuscitation. It is bone coming to his bone, the broken people coming together. And I'm going to read something here from the Christadelphian Studies. It's December 1999, and it's on page 8. This is, I'm going to quote again from Brother Roberts, and then I'm going to have a few words that Brother Danny writes. The establishment of a universal Israelite alliance, 1860, with headquarters at Paris, has laid the foundation of a corporate existence unknown to Jewish life for ages. I've already read this, and I'll read it again. It has given the Jews a rudimentary nationality which cannot fail to be the utmost importance in all future movements for their national resuscitation. It is bone coming to his bone, the broken people coming together. This is taken from the Christadelphian of 1884, on page 18. Brother Danny says this, the last two sentences by Brother Roberts are very pertinent. When we look back on history, We do not see the 2,400-year oppression against the Jews continuing unbroken until we come to 1967. What happened in 1967 when the Jews gained the eastern half of Jerusalem was a progressive result of the events of 1947. That is, when the Jews gained statehood and thus an army, statehood itself was a result of circumstances that outworked from the 1917 Balfour Declaration, in which a Jewish political entity was established in the land. The Declaration of Balfour sprung in large part from the political power which grew out of the First Zionist Congress in 1897. This Congress had its roots in the Universal Israelite Alliance of 1860, of which Brother Roberts prophetically stated, cannot fail to be the utmost importance in all future movements for their national resuscitation. And I would say then that 1860 was a very important year, was it not? Brother Danny also wrote that the time periods of Daniel and the Apocalypse relate almost without exception to the beginning and ending points of significant political epochs, not the time of the personal return of Christ to the household for resurrection and judgment. That Brother Thomas's anticipation of Christ's coming was based upon the termination of a plurality of epochs which related to the saints, the natural Jews, and the Roman system. In other words, he anticipated the time of Christ's descent from heaven by reasonable inference from rightly calculated time periods. Brother Thomas had rightly stated some years earlier that Christ would not return until the times indicated in Scripture had expired, and that those times would not expire until the 1864-68 epoch. He was correct in this. The unknown factor remaining was how much time would elapse after the 1335 and 1260-year periods, which terminated together, had expired until Christ would appear. This is from the Christadelphian Studies, November 1999, page 2. And Brother Danny puts some other points here that I think are interesting. And this is in the October 1999 Christadelphian Studies on page 5. Number 1, believers are responsible for understanding and believing the biblical signs and times that have been faithfully and accurately discerned by past generations. Well, I think that's obviously correct. 2, believers are responsible for discerning the signs and times of their own generation. And in a note in the December 1999, page 4, Christadelphian Studies, it was not meant that Brother Thomas's generation should know the beginning of the seventh millennium because they did not stand related to it. It makes me think, if he was not responsible because enough time had not passed, think where we are and the time that has passed. Are we, look how responsible we might be, you know, for the, since the things that we've seen, and that we maybe sometimes just slough off and, you know, we think, oh well, you know, and I've done that, and maybe you've done that, but without thinking seriously enough about it. 3, believers are not responsible for discerning the times to which they do not stand related, that is, the future times beyond their generation. And 4, believers can be enlightened in the times to which they stand related through the study of the apocalypse. And I know that everyone here is of a strong belief on that matter. You know, one of the reasons that Brother Danny, other reasons that he took the 2400 was this. You remember on the second day of creation, the firmament that divided the waters above from the waters below. And this firmament had, in day two, Nimrod arose in day two. And therefore, that set a firmament between those that were up on high, the powers that be, the mighty hunter, who was against before the Lord or against the Lord, those people in that strata, and the people in the lower strata, those of which had the truth, but were oppressed and suppressed because of it. And so, therefore, the 2 he took is critically important. And the 4, of course, we know that in the fourth day, the great light appeared, did he not, Jesus Christ? And that's, therefore, those two days, 2 and 4, the great light that would shine and overcome the darkness of this second day, this Nimrodian day, is one that Brother Danny, one reason Danny chose the 24, there's the 2400 being the correct number. And see, there's not, it's not just a matter of which scroll or what date was, what was an error and what wasn't an error. It had a lot more to do with the numbers, the 2 and the 4, the 24. And that was another a reason that he took the 2400, and I'm sure Brother Thomas took it for those reasons as well. Now, we look at these again here. These are the primary and secondary applications here, if you look up there. Once again, the 1860 date from Daniel 8:3, Cyrus over Darius. The secondary application, Daniel 8, verses 5 through 8, the 2400 day years minus the 333 BC gets us to 2067. Now, I think Brother Danny, what he did, he backed into the these dates here from here. 2067 would be the date when the temple has been completed, the world is at rest, the sin has, you know, has been quelled, and so on. Worship is going on in this great temple. And the primary application then, and for, we had to look at the 2520 year a day periods, and that's the critical one. And this one is, if you took 2520 day years, we know the 1260 and the 1260, less the 610 or the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, we get to 1910. This is basically the era of, that Brother Thomas believed, you know, was the 40 years after the 1860 date, or 40 years or so after that date, a little more. But he took that. I guess if you put 50 years past it, you'd get it, wouldn't you? 1910. So, but. And then the secondary application of that 2520 day years minus 460, or Artaxerxes' decree to build a temple, beginning of the 70 weeks prophecy, you would get 2060. And now, 2060 is a very critical date as well, because if we're looking at 2067, here's what Brother Danny states on that, is that 2067 is a date of 2060, then the 7 year period, if you take off of 2067, 7 years, and the decree to go, goes out to build the temple, a 7 year period based upon 2 Chronicles chapter 2, that Solomon took 7 years and utilized the Gentiles to build the temple. So we come to 2060. Then we take from 2060, we take 40 years off of that. And that's the 40 years of Brother Thomas. And Brother Danny utilized 30 years as to be the years when the mid-heaven gospel goes out. He used that as the 30-year period. But he also stated that the 30 years was in the seventh millennium. Brother Thomas utilized the 30 and the 10 in the sixth millennium. So, you know, I probably would go with Brother Thomas's 40 years there on that. But if you took 30 years off of that, off of that 2060, you know, and then you took another 10 off of it, we'd be to 2020. Now that 2020 is the period of time when the judgment, there'll be a 10-year period of judgment and the Gogian judgments and so on. We would have a 10-year period there. So that would be 2020. But the thing is, how long will it be for the resurrection? Well, I think Brother Thomas felt that it would be a 10-year period. I think I'm right. That Brother Thomas felt it would be a 10-year period. So if you took 10 years off of 2020, you would be at 2010. And so we're getting a little closer to the 27, I think, that Brother Matt came up with. So, all of this points to the fact is that we're critically looking at time periods that are very near us, and that you can come up with them in numerous ways. And I think we all need to be real careful of what we're looking at here. One of the things that this 2,520 year deal that Brother Danny did this, he said, let's look at the secondary application of the 2,520 year period. Whereas the first, beginning in 1910, marked the final declining phase of the Babylon and Roman kingdom, then it would follow that a 2,520 year period would also indicate the end of that phase. So he said the 70 weeks prophecy of Daniel 9 shows the period between the decree to build the temple and the crucifixion as 490 years. Thus 490 plus 770 equals 1260. There is 490 years from Artaxerxes' decree to the offering of Christ in 30 A.D. Another 770 years brings us to 800 A.D. and the midpoint of the 2,520 year period. And adding another 1,260 years to complete the seven times period brings us to 2,060. The year Danny suggests is the one in which Christ's warfare with the nations ceases. It follows that a period of 40 years there of warfare and bloodshed would have preceded the 2,060 A.D. period. So, and I hope that was is understandable as much as I can do it in a quick amount of time. But I hope that was. I think Brother Danny did a remarkable job in putting all this together, and I think it's worth your reading. Very, very much so. Did everybody get those dates okay? If not, I'll let you look at them later. If I can ever get them all together here. Better turn that off a minute. And now for class three. It's really a critical class in regard to the little horn of the goat, so to speak. And I'm sorry I'm so far behind here, but in verse 15 of Daniel 8, I guess we've talked about this this little horn of a goat a little bit, but this little horn was the one that persecuted Israel so much, and we're going to get back into this in a little bit. But in verse 15, it is understandable that Daniel would be overcome by the visions revealed unto him, especially the events which had impact upon Judah and Jerusalem in the last days of the Mosaic constitution of things, and also the long period of time after that. Imagine if we could see by vision the great events preceding the judgment in Armageddon and beyond. And that's here we are at this point in time. What if we could see what would go on during this, all of these things relating to the judgment and Armageddon and so on? Would that not floor us? I'm afraid I might not want to see it, unless I was like Daniel. I might want to, but I can understand. It must have been an awesome sight for him to see his beloved Jewish people, his country, his Jerusalem, the temple, and all of this just smashed. And so we need to dare to be a Daniel in our time and look, and let's look and see. We want all of our families to be with us. All of our brothers and sisters. We don't want any of them to be lost. And we need to be like Daniel. And we need to help as much as possible as lies within us to help others that do not have an understanding or ability. In the book of Daniel, as I said, there's ample evidence of Yahweh's control of the events surrounding the kingdom of men. The importance of Yahweh's angels or messengers, direct contact with Daniel, and their shepherding of events, highlighting the extreme importance of the visions and prophecies. We are not just looking at historic events which are revealed and then forgotten, but we are looking at events which are logically leading to Messiah's return. You know, you've all heard the saying that history repeats itself. History is being shown to us here and is very closely what we're going to see at the last time. This is not just something that's happened way back there at the end, and we're just throwing a few dates out here and a little history out here. This same type of a situation is going to develop again. And that's why we need to understand what was this situation around the time of Daniel, in Daniel 8, Daniel 7, Daniel 2, Daniel 9, 10, 11, and 12. We need to understand all of these things, and then we need to go to the book Unsealed and understand those just as well. We're not just looking at historic events which are ruled, are revealed, and then forgotten, therefore. Notice that Daniel sought for the meaning. And it says here in 15, "And it came to pass when I, even I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man." Daniel was just grieving and striving for this. He wanted every bit of detail he could, and that's the way we should be right now. I think others have said this very thing. Is there not a lesson here for us then? Are the words of Daniel unworthy to be considered as doctrine or teaching? Should we not pray that our eyes be opened? Is it impossible that the faithful servant of Yahweh might be enlightened? There stood before me as the appearance of a man, as stated here in verse 15. The word for man here is significant. Strong says man or Geber, G-E-B-E-R, means a valiant or mighty man or warrior. And H.P. Mansfield says Geber means strength. This man is none other than Gabriel. And the word Geber forms part of Gabriel's name. In verse 16, the man here, "I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel." This man in verse 16 is not Gabriel. The word for man here is Adam. Now, all we're having here is an angel representing Adam, or man, calling out for the answer to Gabriel. This is all this is. It's not really a man of Adam standing there, but it's an angel. And even Brother Mansfield believes that it possibly could be Michael, the angel Michael, that's standing there, because we know his influence with the nation of Israel and his walking with them and watching over them, Israel. Now, so he's calling up on Gabriel, this angel, this perhaps Michael, to interpret the vision, particularly the time periods involved at the time of the end. And Daniel was between the banks of the Ulai once again, but he's on that canal there, and where this initial vision was given in verse 2. This man, the man or Michael or the spirit-motivated man or Adam, calls upon Gabriel to make this man Daniel understand the vision. And it is logical that Gabriel would be the one to instruct Daniel. It was he who taught Daniel in Daniel 9, 21 to 25 concerning the coming of Messiah. He also revealed unto Zacharias the birth of one who came before Jesus, John the Baptist, and the one who revealed unto Mary the birth of the Lord Jesus in Luke 1, verses 19 and 26. So why wouldn't Gabriel be the one here to give the last vision concerning the Messiah, the coming of the Messiah? He spoke of him at his birth. He's speaking of him at his coming. And this last vision here relates to the time of the end. What we're going to see more at the time of the end, this little horn of the goat, which comes forth in its Roman characteristics. Naturally, the events in verse 17 and 18, the events and revelations would have this overwhelming impact upon Daniel. "So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, Understand, O son of man, for the time of the end shall be the vision. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright." For he was frightened and he figuratively fell upon his own death, so to speak. The realization became evident to to him, I'm sure, that the fulfillment of this great vision would only be after his own death. And you know, Daniel, I think, actually died in 540 B.C. At the time, he gave this last great vision, and he died right after that. I'm not sure the month, but I mean, he died after that. I think that's true. But Daniel understood another thing here too. Not only did he understand his own death, that the final outworking of this vision would happen after his death, but he also realized that this vision would necessitate his own resurrection. What a wonderful thing he saw there. I mean, you know, just think if you were told something like that. Yeah, I mean, no wonder he fell upon himself, face, and death. Well, Gabriel then addresses Daniel with the words, "Understand, O son of man." And this is highly critical as well. You know, as I was doing the book, some of Ezekiel over here several years back, I looked upon the number of times that the son of man was used by the prophet Ezekiel, and it's at least 100 times. And it's a number of times used as a type of Christ. And you know, Christ himself used it to describe himself. The title notes Jesus Christ as a judge, as John 5, verses 25 to 27 notes. I'm going to read a little bit of that. It says, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live. For as the Father hath life in himself, so hath he given to the Son to have life in himself, and hath given him authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man." Very clear, very obvious. Now, Brother Thomas writes in the exposition of Daniel that the time of the end has its beginning and its ending. And this is the problem we have with dates. It has its beginning and its ending. But it also has something more than that. It has a big intermediate period. So when we're figuring dates and we figure, well, this looks important. But you know, sometimes, I think Brother Danny noted this too, sometimes dates, it doesn't have to happen that dates are some big significant event. Now that's something I've always looked for. If it's not a significant event, I'm not going to look at it, you know. But that's not the case. Sometimes it's not a tremendously significant event. Now this, the approach of this is marked by an event connected with Egypt, Brother Thomas wrote in the exposition of Daniel. And its ending is by a consummation connected with Israel. Well, and Brother Richard's going to get into these kings of the north and the south, and I'm not going to say much more about it, but all I can say is a Gogian force that comes down to take Turkey and Constantinople, not Istanbul anymore to me, but take Turkey and then Egypt. We understand then that all of these events of the king of the north and the south relate especially to that end period. My brother Thomas noted the year 1838, of course, very clearly when Egypt pushed to Turkey. And I better not say any more about this. But in 1917, it happened again, and I'll let Richard handle that. But in Daniel 8:19, and he said, "Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for the time appointed the end shall be." In this verse, Brother Thomas's definition of the time of the end has pertinent application. The last end of the indignation relates to the final stage of judgment in the outpouring of Yahweh's wrath. Now Gabriel, of course, once again is the perfect one, and Brother Thomas noted his name to be Mighty One of Power, and I think Brother Jimmy mentioned that in his exhortation. I think the Mighty One of Power is a very good name for Gabriel. And as we have noted, to make this man to understand the vision, he's the perfect one to make this man understand the vision. Gabriel therefore commences to interpret the vision of the ram and the goat in verses 20 to 22 as introductory to the time or the last end of the indignation. And so we need to look at this real closely, the time of the ram and the goat. And Gabriel will carry this vision further and reveal to Daniel that the little horn of the goat and the king of fierce countenance will eventually be broken without hand. And we see this in verses 23 to 25. And in verse 23, and in the latter time of their kingdom, the dominion of the four Greek horns, when the transgressors are come to the full, and Brother Thomas says, so as to cause the transgressors to fill up their measure, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up, or one who understands an intricate language, as Brother Thomas worded. Now, what I want to do here, I want to get into this little horn process here. Of course, you know, we can look at this in Daniel 8, verses 9 to 12, and in verses 23 to 25. And when we're looking at it in 23 to 25, we're especially looking at it in regard to the time of the end. We recognize in Daniel 8:23 that this horn is represented by a king of fierce countenance. And we know in Deuteronomy 28:50, the Lord shall bring a nation of fierce countenance against Israel. And of course that happened in AD 70. And understanding dark sentences shall stand up. This king describes the Latin Greek power in its pagan origins. But we're going to evolve from this a little bit. For in verse 24, we see that he shall destroy wonderfully and shall prosper and practice and shall destroy the mighty and holy people. In AD 70 especially. Now these words exactly correlate with Daniel 11:36, in that this king shall exalt and magnify himself and speak marvelous things against the God of gods. You know, and that's also as noted in Daniel 8:9-12. But here's the thing about it. There is a taste of the growing ecclesiastical nature of this Roman Greek power given in Daniel 8:25. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. Here we find that through his policy, and this is also the latter day Russia will, or Gog will assist this power, he shall cause craft, deceit, or falsehood to prosper in his hand. And I think Daniel 11 gives us a little bit more complete look at this in verses 36 to 39. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and a God whom the fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver, and with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds, or the bazaars of guardians, as Brother Thomas notes, with a strange God, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause him to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. You know, verses 37 to 39 give us a more complete picture of this rising church colossus, this Catholic church. This is basically what we're looking at here in this Roman aspect. This is the rise of the Catholic system that is allied with the imperial king of the East in Constantinople. This is what we're seeing in the time. This is what we're going to see if we're not called. Brother Thomas also says that it's like when God comes down against Turkey, we might not even be here to see it. It's a possibility that the judgment, we've been called to judgment, you know, while that's already been called to judgment. I don't know how, you know, when we think we're going to see certain things, we must remember that the judgment seat may call us away before some of these things really happen. But by not regarding the God of his fathers in Daniel 11:37, we find the Roman king renouncing to a degree the pagan Roman gods and replacing them with a corrupted form of Catholic Christianity. This era is clearly marked in history and especially describes the reign of Constantine the Great from 306 to 337 over the Roman Empire, even all the way down to our day. when the throne of Constantinople shall pass from the Sultan to the autocrat of all the Russias. And so therefore, Constantine, I've said this before here, I think, but Constantine is known in, by the Catholics as the 13th apostle. So that, you know, tells us something about Constantine, that this is the Roman Catholics that say that. So therefore, when we say Constantine is spoken of here in this verse, we understand that we're talking about the Roman system, the Roman power. The little horn power is the Roman, the development of the Roman ecclesiastical system. And of all the things that concern Constantine, none is more significant than his so-called conversion to Christianity. Under his rule, the church became more and more implicated in high political decisions. His victory at the Milvian Bridge put him in power and was noted by the Roman Senate as being achieved by the prompting of the deity. And of course, the deity that they referred to here was the unconquered son. And once again, this is nothing more than Nimrod from Babylon. And according to Henry Chadwick's The Early Church, Constantine was not aware of any mutual exclusiveness between Christianity and his faith in the unconquered son. It was easy for him to draw followers from both sides, seeing as in the Old Testament, Christ was referred to as the Son of Righteousness. So, you know, they always take a little bit out, you know, and use it to corrupt their own beliefs. Therefore, we can see the impetus for Catholicism's growth. We see much such things as the sign of the cross used on his soldiers' shields, and a curious mixture of paganism and pseudo-Christianity. My tongue is up. And from Constantine's time, we also see the power first exercised by the emperor in calling and influencing church councils, which was gradually passed into the hands of the clergy. The bishops of Rome at length carried this to the extreme and magnified himself above all, as Daniel 11:37 notes. Constantine, in his time, the Council of Nicaea was called. Now, this council was one of the first steps in the formulation of the Trinitarian doctrine. The next one was Chalcedon, Chalcedon, was in 451, which further added to this. I think the first one was the Father, and then the Son, and then the Holy Spirit was, or the Holy Ghost, the way they say it was, I think was added in Constantinople in 381, which formulated in concrete the present and appalling doctrine of the Trinity. Well, in 1755, John Lawrence Mosheim published his History of the Church, and he writes that the controversies relating to the Trinity took their rise in the second century from the introduction of Grecian philosophy into the Christian Church, that from the time of Constantine there arose the extravagant veneration for departed saints and those absurd notions of a certain fire destined to purify separate souls, hence also the celibacy of priests and the worship of images and relics. And thus Constantine set the stage for the Bishop of Rome's decree. And that decree was forbidding the desire of women or wives in Daniel 11:37. That was a decree actually put out by the church. And to this day, they follow it to a great extent, although they've modified that somewhat. But Constantine's lavish gifts to the church, the Palace of the Lateran at Rome, it was given to the Pope, enabled more to be built. Relics and images adorned them in regal splendor. Well, the final great act of Constantine set the foundation for the eastern capital of the Roman Empire at Constantinople on May the 11th, 330 A.D. You know, when we say the brass and the iron, we tend to think, well, the brass is strictly the east and the iron is strictly the west. Well, you know, When you look at the east, it's got a lot of Rome in it as well, you know. So we're not gonna. I want to show you an overhead here. I don't know if I better do this or not, but this is kind of a long one. I may have to let you read most of it, if you can. Can you see that? Is that pretty good? I can't. But anyway, I'll just read the last little part. You know, the distinctive elements of this civilization were brought together into the melting pot in the age of Constantine. And if you look at all of that up here, the Byzantine civilization in the east, which Russia is a very big part of, you can see why Russia has such a part to play in this end time. This is from Dmitry Oblensky in his book Russia's Byzantine Heritage. Is one which I some of that I have. So, you know, he made lavish gifts to the church, as I earlier said, and he was really an emperor with a church in his background of a certain sort. In other words, well, we know in Daniel 11:38. According to Brother Thomas, is best exemplified by the Emperor Justinian, who is the fittest representative of the civil element of the power that has yet appeared in Constantinople in its dealings with the God delighted to honor him. The key to Justinian and focus is the fact for the amalgamation of this Western and Eastern leg together in the last. It may not happen, you know, we may not see it right in our time here, but it will happen. And that the Eastern, right now the East and the West don't seem to get along as well, but they will eventually. That's a sure thing. It will happen. And part of the reason being is that they're both Catholic. Both the East and the West are Catholic. Eastern Catholics are almost more Catholic than Western Catholics sometimes. You know, they have a lot of Roman influence in them. Eliot, in his Horae Apocalypticae, wrote that the celebrated letter of Justinian to the Pope, dated March 533 A.D., there was both a solemn recognition of the Pope as head of all the churches and a formal subjugation even of the Eastern churches to his rule. And so this is what we're looking for. We're looking to see this again. It wouldn't be given to us in the way it is. And what I would like to point out, too, and I'm going to have to really zoom now because I'm about four or five minutes, but if you go to the Apocalypse and you go to chapter 12 and you see the man-child there, well, that's Constantine. And so the book Unsealed, showing us the importance of Daniel's vision here in 8, and chapter 11 is speaking of this man-child that comes on the scene and establishes this Christian church, so to speak, on the ruins of the pagan system. And then we go to chapter 13, and there we see, as I think it's already been, 13 has already been looked at, but we see further the dragon brought into this, and let's just look at it a second. It's too kind of. Probably ought to read a little bit of that because it has a great impact on what I've already said. This beast of the sea, I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea having seven heads and ten horns. And once again, we're talking about the Roman aspect here. And upon his heads the names of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, which was the Greek, and his feet were the feet of a bear, which is a Medo-Persian, and his mouth is the mouth of a lion, which is the Babylonian. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. This is exactly what we want to see from Constantinople, is the dragon phase giving the power of the ecclesiastical power back in the West in Rome to give them the authority to carry on with their false doctrines. There's an Nimrodian doctrine, as I like to say it. I probably don't have much time to go any further than that, but we could also look at Focus. Another one is another one who and I probably won't have time to do Focus, but Focus is another one that really supported the Pope back in the West. And once again, these two rulers, and Brother Thomas specifically nominated Justinian as the one which was the most important. And Daniel 8:25, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall stand up against the prince of princes, or as Brother Thomas notes, the commander of commanders, or the commanders of the chieftains, or the commander-in-chief of the army, if you want to say. And in verse 11, Jesus Christ's title, I guess Daniel 8, Jesus Christ's title is S-A-R, but here is S-A-R, S-A-R-I-M, or Brother Thomas said S-A-R, S-A-H-R-I-M, in this verse of 25. But he shall be broken without hand. This is the same as the stone cut out of the mountain without hands of Daniel 2:45, which destroyed Nebuchadnezzar's image, and also is the same as the king of the north's destruction in Daniel 11:45. Well, all of this said and done, this, when they shall say peace and safety, you know, by peace I shall destroy many. If you look at what we're seeing now, we're seeing in the I had some things I wanted to read about what NATO was stating and all, but NATO, the big thing they do is try to, they want peace at all costs, no matter what. And that's what they call, and that's why they're so against the U.S. for going over there and going beyond their control and carrying out these wars and such. But these wars are carried out at the behest of the Almighty Yahweh. That's it was His control of the situation that put the Tarshish powers over in the area where they're supposed to be to ask that question when God comes down, art thou come to take a spoil? The Almighty God placed them there. And it's not up to NATO or anything to decide. But by peace they shall destroy many. What they want to do is to shackle the hands of those that would help the Jew, basically. And then, by peace, then they can do what they want to do. You know, this is the purpose of NATO. And that's a very illegal society that doesn't operate in a godly manner. They support every terrorist. No, they won't even define terrorism because it would indict so many of those terrorists. What they do is they look the other way when Hamas and all those henchmen go against Israel. They won't define it because it defines what Hamas really is a terrorist. And they silence their mouths on these things. Well, this is just the Almighty's way of utilizing this peace, calling of peace. When they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction. Well, I can see where the NATO will have everything they think under their control. And then at the very last, you know, war will be inflicted upon them. I think I've run out of time here. I better stop right there. But I appreciate your attention.